Are we playing plagues bingo? Every time I've given a sermonette recently, I follow some kind of global disaster or conflict. I contributed earlier this year an article on the 75th anniversary of the nuclear war, first nuclear war, Hiroshima, which will be coming up. You'll see that next month in Beyond Today magazine. Now, that seems fitting. Here's the bingo rundown thus far, in case you want a reminder. In January, America and Iran attacked each other. President got impeached. First coronavirus case was recorded in America. The United Kingdom withdrew from the European Union. In February, the presidential Democratic caucuses in Iowa blew up, and in Australia went on fire. So the whole continent started burning. In March, coronavirus was finally declared a pandemic. Italy locked down its entire country. In April, coronaviruses worldwide topped 1 million. The U.S. economy crashed. U.S. went overnight from workforce shortages to record unemployment. In May, we had the race riots, and ground beef went to $8 a pound. So today, overhead, and thankfully we had some rain, so perhaps we haven't seen it yet, but we are now prepared to experience the Sahara Godzilla dust cloud. So as my grandmother would say, July, please come in here like you've got some sense. All of this, of course, reminds me of a story. This one goes back when Ronald Reagan was president. It took place during the Feast of Tabernacles in England. And the feast site there was on the coast of the English Channel, located in what the British would call caravan park. It's a mixture of trailers, what the British call caravans, and small cabins. Pretty simple fare. If you wanted hot water, you had to put 5 or 6 shillings in a meter to heat the water you're up, so you had to get up about an hour early if you wanted a shower in the morning. The cabin had small kitchens. And on the last day of the feast, I invited a number of British widows to come over between services and have lunch. They all gratefully accepted in a very classy manner. So when they arrived in my small cabin, I did what any host in Britain would do. I offered to make them a cup of tea. I figured I'd been making tea all week, so I was up to the task. To their credit, the British widows all good-naturedly swallowed hard and said, "Of course." They would allow this uncultured American to have a go at a major British institution. Those of you who've been to England know what I'm talking about. There's a whole sophisticated sequence to making tea in England. The water has to be heated just so, and the pot and cups warmed up, and so forth. Variation is not permitted. So as I prepared my version of British tea, I could sense a certain degree of tension was heating up. In fact, it would not be an overstatement to say these ladies were starting to quiver. Things got worse as I heated up the cups and prepared to assemble the tea leaves in a little wire mesh container. When I accidentally dropped the container into the teapot, I heard an audible gasp behind me. I thought maybe I should engage them in preparation. So I turned around and seeing barely concealed looks of horror, I said, "I'm having a bit of trouble and challenge in preparing your tea. Would you kindly care to assist?" Of course, they all instantly chorused. Simultaneously, they all rose as one. Gently pushing me out of the way, they collected all the cups and the pot of tea I'd been preparing and dumped it all out in the sink. Then they threw all the wet tea in the trash and completely started over. Sort of like what we're going in 2020 today. These British ladies had learned how to survive in all kinds of major challenges, including a then 30-something Yankee making some kind of abomination that he called tea. As the lunch progressed, I got to the main point of what I'll talk about today. I learned that all these ladies, who were very quiet and proper, they had all gone through the London Blitz. They had all experienced the near-incessant bombing of civilian targets by the Nazi German Air Force. I thought that was amazing back then when I first heard it, but I was recently very humbled to read this newly published account of how people all over Britain survived the London Blitz. It's called The Splendid and the Vile. It's a terrible name, but it's one of the best written books I've ever read. Darris McNeely was recommending it. And if you had to do something when you were locked down, and I bought this and read it, and it was fabulous. So to summarize a couple of things from that, 1940, after France fell, nothing seemed to stand in the way of a British invasion. It was clear the United States was going to do absolutely nothing. As Churchill came to power, he fully realized that England was going to have to stand it alone. France had just fallen, and as he said, the Battle of Britain was about to begin. 1940, the Germans started planning this feared invasion called Operation Sea Lion. So all summer long, the Brits got to watch it. They could see a slow building up of landing craft on the French coast as the Germans prepared to execute their Führer's Directive Number 16. But something happened. Hitler was convinced that Russia would break their secret agreement and attack them sooner and later, so he decided to attack first, which would require all their invasion capacity. So it fell to the German Luftwaffe to soften up Britain. They wanted to massively bomb at first military targets and then hopefully force Churchill to capitulate and the British to sue for peace. So beginning in September 1940 and 1941, following the initial Battle of Britain between the British Spitfires and Hurricanes and the German airplanes, the Germans began to fly thousands of bombers over English and Scottish cities, eventually killing more than 43,000 people. They burned or destroyed billions of dollars of buildings and infrastructure, including priceless centuries-old churches and facilities. Of those killed during that time, 5,625 were young children. It was a war of terror. Several cities were mercilessly bombed, including the nearby harbor of Portsmouth, just a few miles away from where we were having the feast. It's hard to imagine as we sit here even in tranquility, even though we're in the middle of a crisis of various natures. But in that initial blitz, there were 56 bombing raids in 57 days, beginning in September, continuing in October. Then they developed new technology, which was very scary about how they were able to direct these things at night through a radar beam. And they start bombing at night. It was unrelenting terror. So I ask you, have you ever thought what it's like to be bombed? You might have a few minutes warning, but the terrible screech of the falling bombs, followed by explosions and concussion waves that rolled and rolled, that left one's heart and ears fluttering, and you felt it in your chest, and it made you weak. Then came the stench of cordite, the massive dust of hundreds of years of settling in centuries-old buildings and homes, and then the fires, and then the loss of power, and then the screams, and then the people crying out for help as they were buried in a rubble, happened night after night for months. It was horrible, and it came close to success in breaking the will of the English people. But the British, aided by the incredible leadership from Winston Churchill, stood fast, as this book tells you in great detail. They even brewed tea in the underground shelters in London as both an act of defiance and of comfort. After the war, many recognized Churchill as the man who made the difference. Quote, the Prime Minister, one cabinet officer wrote, provided leadership of such outstanding quality that the people almost reveled in the dangers of the situation and gloried in standing alone. Top cabinet secretary wrote, only Churchill had the power to make the nation believe that it could win. But Churchill didn't buy it. He said, I never gave them courage. And this is an important point for us. He said, I was able to focus their courage. As the author concluded, Churchill taught the British people the art of being fearless. So what about us today? In the midst of crisis after crisis, have we learned the art of being fearless? When we see people destroying the cities they live in, when we see people wage war against the very principles of the Bible, when we see the high court of the land declare that the definition of the man and woman is subjective and not biblical, how do we react? In the time remaining, we'll talk about a remarkable Psalm of David that gives us some clues in how to achieve this. This particular psalm is considered a teaching psalm, or what is called a wisdom psalm, as it, instead of many lines of praise to God, it contains line after line of specific instructions. It is written as an acrostic poem, which each line beginning with a succeeding letter from the Hebrew alphabet, but is unusual in that it has two lines for each letter instead of one. That is a form of unusual emphasis in the Hebrew language, as repetition is a strong form of teaching. So I speak here of Psalm 37. This psalm is thought to have been written by King David when he was very old. Quite a bit is written about David's last days in the early chapters of 1 Kings, and this psalm is congruent with those themes. It writes about in the middle of Psalm when he talks about when I was a lad, and referencing his life, what he had seen and not seen. This psalm is unique. It asks questions that other ancient literature about pagan gods fearfully avoid. The main one is this. What do you do when it seems like the bad guys are winning? Or further, what do you do when a trial never seems to end? The psalm is remarkable because the Bible is plain about the rewards for obedience and the punishment for deliberate sin. But we find out in real life that not all is black and white. Things happen for different reasons. When we see sin prevailing like it is during this plague bingo year, with seemingly endless trials and tests, we can get discouraged. We can even be tempted to break faith and give up. So David addresses those issues, and he provides specific instructions in this psalm. Some of our church hymns, as you know, are based on this psalm. Fret not yourself. Jesus Christ quoted from the Septuagint version of verse 11 to begin his famous Beatitudes in Matthew, when he said, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." So, here are a couple of interesting takeaways. The Hebrew language in this psalm, in particular, is very interesting. Many English translations, as you know, you may have returned to Psalm 37 already, but they start out with some variation of "don't fret yourself." We don't talk about fret very often in the 21st century, which is a state of being consciously worried or anxious. That's a bad state. We don't like it. Dr. Robert Alter, a renowned world expert in Hebrew, I've talked about before, he translated the entire Bible. He did not try to the entire Hebrew Bible, Old Testament. He tried to translate it according to the Hebrew language, not trying to fit any variant sect or belief. But he has an interesting comment about the language in Psalm 37. He says Psalm 37 is unique for a variety of reasons. He notes this point. The base root of the words used for the English translation of fret actually mean to heat up, to make hot, to heat up. So he translates verse 1 of Psalm 37, verse 1, this way, quote, "Do not be incensed by evildoers. Do not envy those who do wrong." That English word incensed is quite different from fret. In addition to potentially involving anxiety, which is what we typically associate with the word fret, it reflects slow smoldering anger or resentment. And both slow smoldering anger and resentment are killers of spiritual life. They stop us from doing things, and I'll tell you why. That translation makes sense, as in verse 8, we are specifically told to get rid of anger. The English Standard Version, the ESV, translate verse 8 as, quote, "refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not yourself, for it tends only to evil." Alter translates this, quote, "let go of wrath and forsake rage. Do not be incensed to do evil." So being incensed can actually drive us in the wrong direction. So that's a critical point. When I see evil in the world, I can allow myself to get mad. I can get self-righteous. I can say, this should not be this way. And I want to do something about it. As Jamie will tell you, I walk around in a literally incensed state. She says, knock it off. So I have to recover from that. But when I cognitively allow myself to get in an incensed state, my body physically reacts. Allow me to read you a statement about being incensed from the Mayo Clinic. Quote, "when you encounter a perceived threat, such as a large dog barking at you during your morning walk, your hypothalamus, a tiny region at your brain's base, sets off an alarm system. Through a combination of nerve and hormonal signals, the system prompts your adrenal glands, located on your kidneys, to release a surge of hormones, including adrenaline and cortisol. Adrenaline increases your heart rate, elevates your blood pressure, boosts energy supplies. Cortisol, the one that we're concerned about, which is the primary stress hormone, increases sugars and glucose in your bloodstream, enhances your brain's use of glucose, and does a number of things, including curbing functions that would be unessential or detrimental in a fight or flight situation. It lowers your immune system response for days and suppresses the digestive system. It gives you stomach issues. This complex natural alarm system also communicates with the brain that control mood, motivation, and fear. It says something really bad is about to happen. You ever hear this happen to you right before you drop off to sleep? You're really tired. You lay down, and all of a sudden you think one thought, and it triggers just a tiny bit of cortisol, and then you go to sleep about 3 a.m. Of course, that never happens. That only happens to me, right? Okay. But that's good in terms of being prepared for fight or flight. But if we allow ourselves to continue in this state, we allow ourselves to be reacting, and we become mad and rage and become incensed, that can be a bad thing. So as they continue at the Mayo Clinic, the long-term activation of the stress response system and overexposure to cortisol that follows can disrupt almost all of your body's responses and processes. This puts you at increased risk of many health problems, including anxiety, depression, digestive problems, stomach aches, headaches, heart disease, sleep problems, weight gain, memory and concentration impairment. Anybody check any of those off in the last 4 months? Psychology Today calls cortisol public enemy number one for physical and mental health. It's because once your body has fired up its fight or flight state, it can take more than an hour for your blood chemistry to stabilize. So no wonder then King David urges us to, quote, let go of wrath and forsake rage. Forsake means to abandon, to renounce, to give up. Otherwise, if you embrace rage, you become incensed, which is not a good state. So what are we to do, especially during this onslaught of a year called 2020? We know if we want to get air out of a glass, you fill it up with something else, like water. There are many things like moderate exercise, meditation, and the like that can help us dial back the incense. But David, in several places in this psalm, gives us the main key to dialing back the incense, which is the title of my sermonette today, Dialing Back the Incense. Using Dr. Alter's translation here, David tells us in verse 2, to trust in the Lord, to do good, to keep faith, to take pleasure in the Lord, to trust Him because He will act. Dropping down to verse 6, we read, be still before the Lord and await Him. Do not be incensed by him who prospers. So there's choices here. We can choose not to do this, or we can choose to do something. We read that advice many places in the Bible. Trust in God and he will direct your path. Wait on the Lord. But these can be hard things to do when finances are short, when riots are going on, when personal health is threatened. But that is what this psalm is all about. God, through David, uses amazing, powerful, and graphic language. God says in this psalm that the wicked shall perish, that they will be, quote, gone in smoke, gone. When God says the wicked will wither like the grass, like it says several times in this psalm, everyone living in the Middle East would know what he was talking about. When I lived in Pasadena, like some of you, the foothills north of the city would turn a beautiful emerald green after the winter rains. In barely a month, they would be brown, twisted, and ugly. So it is with the wicked. So it is with people who you think are doing the wrong thing. During this time, I would suggest that this is a good psalm to read slowly on one's knees, drinking deeply in what God says to do and believing what he says. While as an acrostic poem, the psalm ends with a unique triple acrostic, which signifies the sense in Hebrew of remember this. Here's how Dr. Alter translates verses 39 and 40 in conclusion. Quote, the rescue of the just is from the Lord, their stronghold in times of defense, their time of distress. And the Lord will help them and free them. These are promises. He will free them from the wicked and rescue them, for they have sheltered in him. This is what we are to remember. So going forward, let's make the choice not to allow ourselves to become incensed. Let's forsake wrath, and let's not get stirred up for the wrong reasons. Let's trust in God and wait for his deliverance. It's time to make some real tea.